Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
One of the great things about eating a barbecue is sinking your teeth through that crisp, salty, fatty crust on the outside of the meat and then getting into the succulent, moist interior.
Chef Daniel Orr has bellied up to the grill for a few recipes for this Memorial Day weekend. In addition to cooking up some local meat, he'll be making his father's hobo potatoes recipe right in the coals. He also throws together two non-alcoholic drinks using herbs from the garden. Then we speak with two authors who hope to encourage you to play with your food, and a farming cooperative has had to jump through a number of hoops to make sure their land is safe for food. Stay with us. Mia Partlow is back with a look at this week's food news. Hey there, Mia.
Hi, Annie. A new survey by the Kellogg Foundation has revealed much about Americans' attitudes toward fresh food and healthy eating. 68% of respondents claimed to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables now than they did 5 years ago, and 88% said they would pay $1.50 more a month to guarantee farm workers were paid a fair wage. Perhaps lawmakers should take note of these results, because 83% thought that Washington should shift its support from big agriculture towards smaller, local farmers. In food safety news, a California producer has issued a recall for bagged lettuces after listeria was found during a routine check. The lettuces were distributed nationwide and under the brand names River Ranch, Farm Stand, Hy-Vee, Marketside, Sure Fresh, and The Farmer's Market. No illnesses have yet been linked to this outbreak. And does your love of organic food make you a judgmental jerk? That was the question posed by a new study from Loyola University researchers. 62 test subjects were broken into three groups. One group was shown pictures of organic fruits and veggies, another was shown comfort foods like cookies and ice cream, and the third was shown neutral foods like beans and grains. Then they were asked to rate the acceptability of certain activities that have nothing to do with food, like incest or lunching on a deceased pet. The study determined that individuals exposed to photos of organic labeled produce were generally more contemptuous of these questionable activities than test subjects shown images of comfort or neutral foods. Foodies in Twitter Nation had plenty to say about these results, everything from embarrassed agreement to emphatic denial to concerns about the study's method. Read a selection of these comments on our website and add your two cents, eartheats.org.
Visit the Facebook page and the Twitter feed to get news all week long. Just search for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow, thanks.
You got it.
Across the Corn Belt, the planting season is off to a roaring start. And with farmers expected to pull in more acres of corn than they have since the Great Depression, this fall's harvest could be one for the record books. Sarah McCammon reports from Iowa for Harvest Public Media.
It's too early to predict whether this year's harvest will set a record, but it's looking pretty good right now.
This corn crop will knock your socks off if all the stars line up and the good Lord gives us that blessing.
That's Bill Kauser. He grows crops and raises cattle near Nevada in central Iowa. Dressed in black overalls, he trudges through a field dotted with remnants of last year's corn stalks and inspects the tiny leaves that are beginning to poke through the dark soil.
You can just start seeing everything kind of popping up through. So,
like lots of corn growers here, Kauser's planting has moved along quickly thanks to a mild spring. But at 57 and after decades of farming, Kauser knows better than to get too excited just yet. A lot could still affect the crop, from droughts to floods to pests and diseases. But starting early can give farmers an edge. The National Corn Growers Association's Paul Bertels says the plants have more time to grow before they're up against Midwestern midsummer scorchers.
The sooner you get the crop in, provided you don't have a cold snap, you get that plant in, you get it established, and a lot of times you'll actually get that corn plant through pollination. before the real heat of the summer comes.
Corn growers nationwide are planting at about twice the rate of a typical year. More than half the crop is already in the ground. And not just that, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says farmers intend to plant more than 95 million acres of corn this year. That's 4 million more than last year and close to 10 million more than the year that yielded the biggest harvest yet. If farmers follow through on those plans, it would be the most acres of corn since 1937. And better seeds and improved farming methods mean yields are a lot higher now, so we're likely looking at what could be a bumper crop. Despite Kauser's optimism, though, he worries about the downside. A big crop could suppress prices while the cost of farming holds steady.
Farmers are their worst enemies because what we do is we always do what we do best, and that's overproduce. If we have more corn than what we can use in ethanol, what are we going to do with that corn? The cattle numbers are down right now. The hog numbers have stabilized. So where does that corn go?
Never fear, says Chad Hart. It will go somewhere. He's an economist with Iowa State University Extension. Hart says corn prices would probably drop a bit, maybe a dollar or so below today's price of more than $6 a bushel, but that's still a lot better than the $2 or $3 corn was fetching as recently as the mid-2000s. And Hart doesn't expect any shortage of buyers.
We've seen ethanol demand really take off over the past 5 years. We're also starting to see export demand, specifically to the Pacific Rim, build over the last couple of years. So as long as that demand for the crop continues to build as quickly as our yield increases go, that can help us maintain prices at a fairly healthy level.
Healthy prices plus a healthy crop could mean the stars align perfectly for corn farmers this year. But if there's anything a farmer will tell you, it's never count your bushels before they're harvested. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sarah McCammon in Des Moines.
Grilling season has officially begun, and Chef Daniel Orr has dusted off his charcoal grill to celebrate. Our first dish today is being cooked in the grill, actually. You should get this going right away because it needs to cook for a long time, so consider prepping this dish long before your guests arrive. This is our hobo potatoes with onions and garlic.
This was a recipe that my dad taught me when I was a Cub Scout and Boy Scout. We're going to make kind of a long sausage shape package. And we're going to first take some aluminum foil. I'm going to take about 3.5 foot long pieces and kind of overlap them to make one big square. Okay, and I'm going to turn this over so the shiny side is out. Okay, I'm going to take a bowl and I'm going to put the fingerling potatoes in. I'm just going to cut them in half. And the reason you cut them in half is so that they can kind of suck up some of the flavors we're going to put in there. If you left them whole, the flavors wouldn't penetrate the skins as well. Just kind of enrobe these with some good olive oil. And this is a time where you can use good olive oil. And to this, we're going to add diced onions. We're going to add a good tablespoon of minced garlic. All right, now I'm going to cut the poblano open. Nice fresh ground pepper. Now, it may sound like I'm putting a lot of pepper in there. It's just that my pepper mill sucks. Hopefully, Earth Eats will pay me enough that I can buy a new pepper mill.
Fat chance, buddy.
The beautiful thing about this dish is you literally put the foil directly in the coals and forget about it as you cook everything else on the grill above it. The longer the potatoes, onions, and peppers cook, the more tender and flavorful they'll become. Maybe just check on them every so often to make sure the fire hasn't scorched through the foil.
One of the great things about eating a barbecue is sinking your teeth through that crisp, salty, fatty crust on the outside of the meat and then getting into the succulent, moist interior.
Doesn't that sound good?
We have two temperatures on the grill. The hot side is for getting color and crispiness, and the cool side is where the meat finishes cooking. We'll be applying the barbecue sauce to the meat after we've moved it over to the cool side to avoid the inevitable flare-ups that come with cooking meat drenched in a sugary liquid over a hot flame.
I've got some nice pork ribs. What I've done with these is I've rubbed them with a coffee espresso rub, which is we call a Columbus Cowboy rub. We've steamed these in the steamer, wrapped in plastic, for 90 minutes. And so they're cooked through, they're tender. What I'm going to do now is I put them on the hot side of the grill. You hear them sizzling, and we're going to get some nice smokiness to them. The coffee, we use a really finely ground espresso. That's going to add to that roasted flavor that you're going to get from the grill. And so it really accents that the flavor of the pork and brings out the sweetness of the pork. This is some of Jim Fiedler's pork from Fiedler Farms, which is in Rome, Indiana. He does totally pastured pork. You can tell by this nice fat crust on the outside.
As the ribs are cooking, we put some boneless pork chops on the grill. Now, these were not pre-cooked. Pork chops just don't really need it.
And I want these to be a little rosy.
A little rosy.
A little rosy. I don't want to have them well done. So I'm going to, you know, get a nice sear on them. Now, see, there is a lot of fat on it, so it will create some flare on the fire. But once I get them marked on both sides, I'll put them off to the side and let them slow cook until they get kind of medium rare on the inside. The other things that I have here that I'm going to get started is I've got some lamb necks. What we've done is we've boiled these for about 2.5 to 3 hours and made a really nice lamb stock. And then we have these necks, and there's a lot of great meat on there. It's great for people that like pulled pork and like moist, well-done, kind of saucy meat, and we're going to throw some barbecue sauce on those. You can see that we've got a nice crust forming here on the pork. We can kind of pull this off to the side, and as you let it sit, they call it carryover cooking, so that means the heat starts penetrating deeper into the meat and continues to cook. Also, the blood and the moisture from the inside of the meat will start to go back out to the exterior, so when you cut it, it'll be a nice rosy texture all the way through instead of rare in the middle and well done on the outside. So you always want to let your meat rest after you've seared it.
So the neck is sticking to the grill. I take that's a good sign.
That's a good sign here. Take a little nibble of that.
I'm a believer.
Isn't that good?
Especially with the crunch on the outside.
Yeah.
You can take a look at a photo slideshow of our afternoon by the grill on our website. Included are some extra photos of grilled veggies and burgers to give you even more ideas for your own cookout. Check it out at eartheats.org. All this eating, and we've yet to prepare a drink. Well, that's easy enough to solve. These two non-alcoholic drinks are great for anyone looking to wet their whistle, kids and adults alike. Chef Orr wandered out into his garden and came back with some fresh lavender to use in our first recipe, Earth Eats Take on Lemonade.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to go back and do another simple syrup, which we've done many times on Earth Eats. It's equal parts sugar and water. Okay, we're going to bring that to a boil. All right, we're going to add some lavender to that. You know, a nice little handful, I would say.
Stems and all.
Stems and all are in there, and you can use the leaves. And if you want to taste that, I'll give you a little.
Oh, that is amazing. The smell turned into taste.
Yeah, I do lavender ice cream sometimes. You can also make a vinaigrette, a lavender vinaigrette. It's nice to crumble up some of the lavender flowers, mix them with breadcrumbs, and sprinkle them on top of a roasted fish.
Add a half cup of the simple syrup with lavender and a half cup of lemon juice to a pitcher, then fill the pitcher the rest of the way with sparkling water.
And you could take it to the table like that, and you can see there's kind of this layer of the syrup and lemon juice in the bottom with that kind of light lavender hue. And then right before you serve it, take your iced teaspoon, stir it up, and that is our summertime lavender lemonade.
Fresh juices are a great way to cool down in the summertime and enjoy the bounty of the season. But this is certainly not your everyday glass of apple juice. We're using cayenne pepper, lemon, and sage.
A lot of people are afraid of sage. To me, it smells great. A lot of people, especially, now try it eating it a little raw.
That's not so great, maybe. a little pine sol.
But when you cook it, it changes automatically. So here's the cayenne. Very, very spicy. We're just adding a pinch. The reason I keep a lot of it at home, because it's something you really don't use very much of, I sprinkle it on my edamame and around my different greens to keep the rabbits away from them. So once they get a bite of it, they don't come back to your patch. So, all right, we're going to add a little bit of that turmeric and a little honey to sweeten it. Okay, we're going to squeeze those lemon rounds right in there and then drop them in. And the peel will add a touch of bitterness, which will be a nice accompaniment to the other flavors in this drink.
That's great. And the sage is there, but it's definitely different. How did you think to pair apple juice with sage?
Having too much apple juice and too much sage around.
You just combined the two and figured out.
So I said, let's try something different. And I originally had it as a hot tea because it also, sage is supposed to have some medicinal qualities and that little bit of cayenne pepper. As a hot drink, it's very good and kind of soothing when you have a cold. And then I put the leftovers in the fridge and it tasted great cold, so that's how it kind of happened.
If you wanted to turn it into an adult beverage in the evening, what would you do?
You could put a splash of vodka in it, or you could put some Prosecco with it, have an apple sage mimosa or Bellini kind of drink.
Go to the website to find out more non-alcoholic drink recipes like our sour cherry fizz. Memorize that website, eartheats.org. Coming up...
The PCB is the first issue. We wouldn't buy the land until we had environmental testing done. Did 6 high-precision independent tests for PCBs across the property and had a non-detect across the board.
That's Danny Weddle of Dandelion Village. Testing for chemicals on the land was the first of many issues he confronted when starting the farming cooperative. Lee Bush brings us that story in just a few moments. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop.
It's a heaven up high.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors putting out everything from cookbooks to food history books. This week, we're starting a new segment here on Earth Eats where we feature snippets of those interviews. Our book today is Funny Food, 365 Fun, Silly, Creative Breakfasts by Bill and Claire Wurzel. It's a picture book that show step by step how to transform breakfast foods into whimsical characters like a grapefruit monkey face.
Well, you know, these breakfasts started out, they were made for Claire, and there was no really thought of doing a book.
Here's 1 minute with the authors of Funny Food, Bill and Claire Wurzel.
I think I started playing with my food when I met Claire. It was just, you know, we always had a great time. We're married 50 years, we're still having a great time.
I mean, just this morning, as a matter of fact, what is typical is Bill will ask me, so what do you want to have for breakfast? And this morning I had the most incredible scrambled egg that was actually a little chick with different colored tomatoes on it.
What I've been doing is I've been more conscious of making it accessible for people. Some people say, well, I'm not an artist, you know, even if it's putting 4 raisins on a little piece of pineapple.
In fact, it's sort of odd that this is even in the cookbook category. It's more, I would say, a lookbook. You know, look at the food and let it inspire you to do your own.
Look, yeah. Look, when you really boil it down, it's romance. In this case, I did it for my wife. I love her. That's what it's all about. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Read more about Funny Food on our website and see the beachscape Bill created using seasonal Indiana ingredients like strawberries, asparagus, and greens. Thanks, Bill. We love it. EarthEats.org. Starting a new farming cooperative in Bloomington, Indiana, has involved quite a bit of work for the folks of Dandelion Village.
from clearing the land to testing for chemicals to deciding which plants will thrive in southern Indiana's clay-based soils. Lee Bush met with the co-founder to find out how they're making it happen.
Danny Weddle, co-founder and soon-to-be resident of Dandelion Village, descends along a path towards a valley that has been partially cleared to make way for planting and building. The tangled secondary forest and thin green sprouts may not seem like much, but there's a lot going on in this 2.25-acre plot just minutes outside of downtown Bloomington, Indiana.
So the first year was cleaning up all of the stuff that had grown up. We spent a large amount of time clearing honeysuckle, which is an invasive mid-level shrubbery plant. And we spent some time on euonymus as well, which is ground cover that kills everything native.
Bloomington is also known for the highly toxic pollutant polychlorinated biphenyl, or PCBs. This particular site is located next to a PCB Superfund site, JB Salvage and Junkyard Recycling Center, and a train track, potentially a risky place to be growing food.
The PCB is the first issue. We went by the land until we had environmental testing done. Did 6 high-precision independent tests for PCBs across the property and had a non-detect across the board. It's incredibly awesome for the neighborhood.
Danny ended up testing for more than 60 pollutants and 12 heavy metals with only 3 hits on materials at non-hazardous levels.
And we'll probably even still take some methods of heavy mulching and other things to ensure things break down. And we're taking the water that runs off of the salvage yard into a culvert, taking that straight into our pond and then out so it doesn't get a chance to wash across any agricultural land.
Looking across the valley from the top of the sloped property towards the tree-hidden train tracks, you can see small green sprouts blanketing the cleared land.
So we cut those garden beds in. And then on the bottom field, we disked that as well and planted winter rye there and in the orchard.
Rye is a hardy grain that is tolerant to Indiana's clay-based soils. When sown in late fall, it produces a ground cover that holds soil in place, helps prevent soil compaction, and improves the overall tilth, or soil condition. Danny considers how the Dandelion Village will be best laid out, especially considering that houses and gardens both rely on being on the southern slope to take advantage of the sun's energy. Luckily, orchards have different environmental needs.
You always put trees on the north-facing slope because it's cooler longer and it keeps their buds from breaking and then they don't get frosted off, so you got a better chance of having fruit. So that's, you know, part of what goes into planning what actually physically happened to the property is understanding the energy flows onto it, which is the whole realm of permaculture. How does energy move? How do you use it easily? So north-facing slope makes a lot of sense because it keeps your trees cooler longer.
Hear Lee Bush's complete conversation with Danny Weddle on our website, where he talks about using a German gardening technique called hugelkultur to put material from the cleared forest to good use, eartheats.org. And learn more about Dandelion Village on their website, dandelionvillage.org. A compote is basically fruit cooked down with sugar. Add whatever seasonings you like, and your compote could work just as well in a dessert as in a first-course cheese plate. We'll be using rhubarb today, which is not actually a fruit, it's a vegetable. Unlike some vegetables, you definitely cannot eat the leaves on a rhubarb plant. They're toxic. But waste not, want not. Chef Orr suggests grinding the leaves down and using them as a bug repellent.
Now, I grow rhubarb in my garden, and you can see it right here. It has a long stem, almost like celery, and then a big, big leaf, almost like an elephant's ear. What you normally do is get a nice big crop of rhubarb in the late spring, early summer, and then you let the plant grow back through the late summer and into the fall, and that what that does is it re-nourishes the root system, so then next spring you'll have more rhubarb. So you don't want to cut your rhubarb too late into the season. All right, so we bring the rhubarb in the kitchen. What we're going to do is slice it up, and today we're going to make a rhubarb compote, but you could use it in many of the same ways that you use in apple butter. Again, you could serve it with pork, you could serve it with duck, or you can use it as a pie filling like we're going to be using today. And rhubarb has kind of a sweet, sour flavor, so it does work well with meats that have some fat in them. Also would be good with game. Okay, to this we're going to add some sugar, and that will start pulling out the moisture in the rhubarb. A little bit of lemon juice in there to get it going. Again, playing off that sour flavor. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to let this cook down until it almost purees itself. It will It's almost like celery now, kind of crisp and crunchy. But as it cooks slowly, you can add a little more water if you need to. It will become very, very soft and mushy and then turn into almost like an apple butter consistency. What we have here is a pre-baked tart shell. This is puff pastry. We're going to fill the inside with some of this rhubarb and top it with the strawberries. Now what I've done is I've macerated the strawberries with a little bit of strawberry jam so they're nice and shiny. All right, a couple sprigs of mint, and you've got a perfectly wonderful, easy dessert that just tastes like summer in Indiana.
For this next recipe, we had a friend bring in some rhubarb.
These are some that actually Chef Bob, who you've met on other episodes of Earth Eats, grew in his garden. So you couldn't get much fresher than that. He picked it this morning, and we're going to stew it down with some sugar. So just cut it into little pieces. You know, the first things that came up in the spring were really celebrated. You know, the wild herbs that I talk about, a lot of them are slightly bitter, like the dandelions. I usually like to dress them with some honey mustard vinaigrette. But, you know, hints of spring peeking out from under the ground was just something to celebrate. So rhubarb is one of those things. Add about a cup of water and about 2 cups of sugar. Okay, we're just going to cook that down. I'm going to add the juice of 1 lemon. Okay, and then it's really up to you how you want to season this. Today we're going to put some ginger in it. And when the ginger has nice smooth skin, you don't really need to worry about peeling it. And the best ginger, if you ever see it in the market, is when it's really, really young and fresh, and it has almost a pink blush to it. If you like ginger a lot, you can always add more. If it's not your favorite, you could leave it out completely and maybe add orange zest and orange juice. I'm going to put a pinch of dried vanilla. I'm going to add a little bit of one of my seasonings, which is called New Regime Blend.
There's a little bit of everything in this, too. Like, there's some anise in here?
Yes, there's star anise, there's some ground pepper, there's fennel seeds, coriander. Okay, and finally we're going to add the rhubarb. Okay, and then we're going to cook this down until it becomes kind of like a chutney or compote.
The cheese we're using for our cheese plate comes from Judy Shad and the folks at Capriole Farms in Greenville, Indiana. They've been making handcrafted cheeses with milk from their herd of animals for over 30 years now.
Actually, I even used her cheeses when I was in New York City. These are her aged cheeses. These are kind of her masterpieces, so they should be enjoyed alone. This is the Wabash Cannonball. Then we have the Old Kentucky Tome, and then the Juliana. That one's real funky, so you have to be a cheese lover to like that one. And then we're going to serve it with something I know you don't like very much, but our little biscuits.
Oh, gosh, I hate those. Ugh.
So we have some of our grandma's biscuits that I've cut up and toasted lightly.
And see, by hate, I mean really sort of adore, because they're fantastic.
They just have a way of coming back. They're one of those comfort foods that I use a lot. And what you can do with the leftover biscuits is what we're doing today. You can cut them, toast them off, and use them as biscuit biscottis and accompany them with goat cheeses and different desserts. So that is our Hoosier cheese plate with the rhubarb ginger compote.
A note about cheese, it should be served at room temperature for maximum flavor and so that it softens a little bit. Cheese lovers will want to come back next week to hear our interview with Paul Kinstedt, author of the new book, Cheese and Culture. In the meantime, there are plenty of cheesy recipes on our website, like our goat cheese ball. Or if you're a DIY type, check out blogger Amy Jeanroy's post about making your own cheese. Find all this and much, much more at eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Thanks for listening and happy eating. I'm Annie Corrigan.